Okay. It's obviously a huge pleasure to be here. It's been a lot of fun. Although I have to say I've been agonizing a little bit about what talk to give today and changing it almost on a daily basis every time I hear another speaker say, oh, I better do something else. And so after Cassandra's talk and deciding to change the talk again, I decided I was going to try to reach this optimum where, on one hand, I have something that is very illustrative for the students of different ways that we approach this problem, and at the same time having some stories that are complete so that you can see a question getting answered, and at the same time getting some unpublished data. So I think the title of my talk is on studying stuff, and then the only common thread here is going to be compartmentalization. The lab, I run a lab at the Instituto Gulbenkian de Ciência in Portugal. It's a beautiful seaside place. It's very, you're most welcome to come and visit as soon as you want. We are interested in these problem intercell compartmentalization, which I will tell you about in a bit. And I guess this fancy term that's called emergence evolutionary cell biology is saying that we study evolution at that one specific level. Until very recently, most of our approaches have been most on comparative genomics and bioinformatics tool building. I'm going to try to illustrate both of them here. And then something changed, which was Ricardo arrived in the lab and then changed everything. And now we have a lab, we spend money, we agonize about money, and do all things that normal scientists do in the lab. And while I have a very short attention span and find most everything interesting, there is a common thread here is that we try to focus on three levels of compartmentalization that I'm going to discuss: microbial-derived organelles, inner membrane systems, and cells within cells, so endosymbionts and parasites. So what I plan to do for today is a very brief introduction of this notion of compartmentalization. This is one slide, so it's very, very brief. And then give you a series of vignettes about this idea of cells living inside cells, which is something I find fascinating. And then, being optimistic, I want to discuss a little bit of a different level of analysis, which is studying properties of protein repertoires and happen to be proteins involved in microtubule organizing centers, sorry. So compartmentalization. I guess it's sort of intuitive that the eukaryotic cell is compartmentalized. Compartmentalized in the sense that you have these units that are physically separated from the rest of the cell, that have an internal environment that's different, that allow for biochemical compartmentalization, meaning that you can do one biochemistry in one place that's different from what you do on the outside. We tend to I guess the most obvious way of compartmentalizing stuff is via internal membranes. So the whole endomembrane system would be an instance of this compartmentalization. We've done some, over the years, work on this. I'm not going to talk about this today. And the more recent interest for us is the idea of protein-based compartments that I think on the limit you have these structures in the cell called vaults. You basically have proteins coming together and forming a box. And box that does something inside. It's not completely clear what they do. But you have structures like the cilia and centrosome that Monica's spoke about that actually, particularly the cilia, form a completely distinct compartment. Again, different in the inside than what it is on the outside. And the barrier happens to be proteins at the base of the cilium. And then you have this beautiful thing that you have cells living inside cells. So you all know about mitochondria. We discussed mitochondria here already, which is a bacteria living inside an eukaryote, a bacteria living inside every single eukaryote, as far as we know. And there's many other cases that we're going to discuss today. So while this is going to be most focus of my talk, we'll notice that there's many other types of compartmentalization. The simple fact that I have something happening on a time in which something else is not happening means that I'm separating these two processes. And these cells do this a lot. And obviously, micromolecular assemblies, phase transitions, we've discussed phase transitions here, is yet another level of compartmentalization. I'm not going to discuss them at all, so I just want to put a place mark here so that you remember these just instances of compartmentalization. Now, what most of you will consider is that, yes, the eukaryotic cell is really, really complex, and the prokaryotic cell is, well, pretty lame. Which I'd like you to consider that you're wrong, if that's what you thought, because the prokaryotic cell is highly compartmentalized. every single type of compartment that you have in a eukaryotic cell, you have at least one prokaryotic cell that has it. You have membrane-based separation compartments, you have protein-based separation compartments, you have temporal-based compartments. This is just some EM of compartments in prokaryotes. Just I think you can see some membranes, you can see these are things called gas vesicles, if memory serves. You have all sorts of things happening there. So this is something that is now becoming much more clear, although what is the exact meaning of compartmentalization of prokaryotes is not completely clear yet. What seems to be the big difference between this group of guys here and the group of guys here is that the number of different compartments you can have in prokaryotes and eukaryotes, where eukaryotes are very exuberant in their compartmentalization. Prokaryotes tend to be very much more focused with one or two types, and no, usually no more. So this is a framework of a problem we'd like to understand. How do you end up separating things from the cell? So what I'm going to do today, then, is try to give you stories that illustrate different levels of analysis at how cells get to live inside cells, one of these type of compartments. And again, time permitting, we'll go to protein repertoires. I'm making an effort, as usual, speaking slowly. I may get very excited, sometimes it happens, and then you'll stop understanding me because I speak too fast, and that's the time you start waving and say, slow down, please do. It's useful. Okay. Between non-cilia and cilia proteins is a very active process. Within membranes, it tends to be an active process. Things like these protein shells, it's really not clear. It's likely that's going to be it's not a random process, but if it's, say, energy dependent that requires specific trafficking, there's very little known about these things yet. I would say probably, but anyway, so this is the types of things we're going to discuss today is how prokaryotes get to live inside eukaryotic cells as organelles or symbionts or parasites. There's one case I'm just going to show you in the interest of natural history. I'm just going to show an example of cell bacteria living inside bacteria. We're not going to discuss much. I'm going to give a lot of effort in discussing a developmental pathway in bacteria that gives rise to bacteria living inside bacteria. And then later in the talk, we're going to discuss how eukaryotes get to live inside eukaryotes. So this is our natural history moment, where we go say that there's this beautiful bacteria called Delovibria bacteriophorus that actually, it's this flagellated thing, goes inside a cell, replicates inside a cell, eats it from the inside, and then just goes away looking for the next prey. This is an example of intracellular parasitism of a bacteria towards another bacteria. Again, as usual, nature will always find an example of anything that you want, but there's more examples like this. So just natural history moments. What I'm going to do now, I'm going to focus on this specific process. Microbiologists call it a developmental pathway. Developmental biologists that study multicellular organisms usually take issue with that. I don't. So I guess all of you have heard about Bacillus subtilis. He's one of the workhorses of modern microbiology. You know that Bacillus subtilis, like most bacteria, justifies vegetatively in the petri dish. But when stressed, Bacillus subtilis can do something else. So this is your normal vegetative cycle. But when stressed, it actually activates a genetic program that forces a asymmetric cell division where a new type of cell, which is going to be called the spore, is formed. And then, so the cell eventually divides, it's invaginated, there's a membrane inversion, it's a very interesting process. A coat is deposited on it, and eventually in Bacillus subtilis, the mother cell will lyse, giving rise to a dormant cell type, which is a spore. The spore is the most resistant cell type known to man. Spores have been shown to resist everything you can throw at them. They resist chemicals of all sorts of descriptions. They resist temperatures of hundreds of Celsius, so 500, I think, is the upper limit. They resist absolute vacuum. Fine, they go up to space and come back, and they're fine. And they resist the most nasty of all things that you can do to a cell, which is time. So, and the reason why I became so interested in studying endospores, so these things are called endospores. for obvious reasons. The reason why I became so interested in studying them, because we have a researcher that is going to feature prominently here in an institute nearby who studies these things. And one day I was having lunch at Gulbenkian, and like normally happens, some random guy sits next to you and just starts talking to you about these bacteria. You're really not paying much attention until he takes a piece of amber from his pocket. And inside the amber, there is an insect. And he says, this amber is from Costa Rica. We know we can date it for a variety of ways. It's about 50 million years old. And if we now break this out and break this insect apart, the bacteria that are in the gut are going to germinate tomorrow, and they are going to be fine. These ones are the claims that are supported by, and not, that will not questioned by most people. The ones that are more questionable are claims of stasis of 100 million years, of which bacteria isolated from salt mines, and but there, the, if there was contamination or not, it's not clear. But even 50 million years of stasis is kind of impressive. This is it. And the moment someone tells you it, and you start immediately thinking about life came from outer space, and it was brought on spores. And believe it or not, we're going to test this hypothesis in the next few minutes. And the answer is no, just to get you. Now, they are very relevant in a variety of reasons. So you might remember here that the scare with the anthrax spore, anthrax attack. So anthrax is one of these forms of spores, and the white powder that people talked about on the news is basically anthrax spores. But more than anthrax is really not a problem in general. What is really a problem is Clostridium infections, where they kill most of our old people in hospitals. So every time they go there, they find they have a cough, they go there, they stay there overnight, they get the diarrhea, they die. That's Clostridium difficile. It's really hard to study, because the problem with these bacteria is that you give them antibiotics, the stress conditions, they sporulate, they wait until the antibiotic goes away, and then they come back. And it's really, really complex to deal with them. And at this point, Clostridium difficile, you really don't only control it properly with fecal transplants, because antibiotics really are not doing it. So it's kind of biomedically relevant. So this is the work. So this is our collaborator, the guy that you should avoid, because every time he takes amber from his pocket, he enlists more collaborators. And this is mostly the work of what was at the time a young trainee that's now moving to Heidelberg to do a PhD, and a postdoc that later joined to help finishing the problems. And Anna Kasich is now an independent researcher doing virus stuff. So the questions we've been interested is basically the ones that are highlighted here. When did it emerge? And this has to do with the question of the origin of life. Did spores bring life to Earth? Where is this sort of seed particle? We're not going to discuss this about how did it emerge and why did it emerge. Although that really bugs me. Why would you develop such a resilient cell type? What could be the drive? Because we tend to think, I would tend immediately to think, oh, anything is neutral. But getting a neutral process gets you something so tough, as I'm very divided on that one. So we want to know what is its relationship to exosporulation, because latent cell types, it's something that actually nature has invented. Well, we've seen nature many times. We don't know if these are reinventions or basically variations on the same program. Okay, and what's the reasons of the spore resilience? And there is a very methodological issue here, which how can we determine if a species forms endospores? And this was at the time that we were doing this was very relevant, because some people were making some claims about endosporulations, like mycobacteria, tuberculosis, and all that. That's all bogus, but we were worried about that. Now, the first thing that you need to do when there's someone like a bioinformatician that approaches a project is basically trying to see what we know about that. And basically what you know about the genes involved in the process, how is the process regulated. So this is actually you spend the first months of work just going over the literature, trying to organize it, and as usually realizing that microbiologists, like any brand of biologists, have no discipline whatsoever, which means that they use words randomly to call different things by different names. So trying to make sense of it, imply even trying for our own purpose, trying to say, okay, these different words, what do they mean? Oh, they're all the same thing. And just organizing controlled vocabularies for our internal work, organizing data into our own internal databases was a lot of work, and work that's invisible afterwards. But I think for the students, relevant to know that this is part of this. So the first question you're going to ask is, when did endosporulation emerge in evolution? So the way we ask this question is by, we've cataloged all the components for which we have functional data that they are regulators of endosporulation. sporulation, or physical components of the endospore. That's it. We have a list of genes. We're basically going to try to figure out what is their age. And we do these in two ways, but the generic principle is that you map orthologs, so you map what is, would be the same thing onto the tree of life and see in what branches they rise. And so the earliest branch that you can map it to, that's what you call the origin, the time of origin. So there are going to be two approaches, one which is very automated. You just have a heuristic to say, if this gene, I find a gene that's similar to my gene in that other species, and it obeys a simple criteria. Here, it's something that works really well for bacteria, it's called bidirectional best hits. It's a heuristic, it's a hack that we do to infer orthology. In bacteria, as I said, it's okay. We start with all the genes that are, actually there's more than here, the ones are here, these are just for illustrative purposes. They are organized into different phases that are organized by, controlled by different regulators. But every time, so this is a tree, you don't see in detail, you don't need to see that. In blue are endosporulating species. In red are known endosporulating species, so species we're absolutely sure, as far as science allows us to be sure, that don't form endospores. And in pink, purple, you have exosporulating species. Each of these dots, each of these columns represents a gene that we know in Bacillus subtilis or Clostridium is a regulator of endosporulation. And now we map orthologs. So immediately what you see, by the way, this is, to give you an idea of the scale of this analysis, this is a few years old already, and this is just many hundred genomes. So this is really completely automated. But then we need to make these smaller figures, otherwise you don't really aren't able to explain anything. But every time you have a black dot there, it means this gene is found in that species. If there's no black dot, it means it's not. So what you see means that there's a group of genes that are basically present all over with normal phylogenetic variation. And these tend to be, when you look at them, like basic metabolic genes. You need basic metabolic pathways to make a spore. And so when you do screens for spore formation, if you delete carbohydrate metabolism, you don't form spores because you need carbohydrates to make the coat. But these are generic things. They're not very specific, so they're not going to be very informative about the age of the spore. But then you have a series of genes, say this column here, this initial column, which, these are the ones that are universal. And then you have a series of genes here which are not metabolic, tend to be very, very specific. And those, what we found here and what we're trying to illustrate here, is that they only exist in species, in a systematic way, in species that are known to form endospores. By the way, the species that are here is basically the list of our certainties about sporulation. These were the species for which we actually have physical evidence. So there's someone tested and imaged spores. If you didn't, we didn't include it in this analysis at the time. This one, yes, this is an intracellular parasite that is there in the middle. I don't remember the name, but if you see here, that block there, so here the color scheme is different. Yellow is presence, blue is absence. You have, you look at a group of organisms here that have very little, almost nothing is detectable. So intracellular parasites, as we're going to see later, have massive, massive genome reduction. And so many of these metabolic genes have disappeared. And we're going to see which ones. Actually, that's the next stage. Can I ask you to go back to that? Because actually that's something I want to question. If you don't mind, like five slides, I think. Sir? Okay. The problem with these analyses is that they are very coarse-grained because you just tell the computer find orthologs, and then computer tells us, give us, yeah, we have many here and there, but it's really, it's very hard to assume because you're just asking the computer to decide for you if things are orthologs or not. So what we've done is to look at these, so these things that you see here, these groups, are basically regulators that control independent phases of spore development. They're the sigma factors and the spo factors, and know very well what they do. They tend to be very specific. We know they tend to be very specific. So what we did is they're part of very large families of transcriptional regulators. And we basically use these very large, combine these very large scale analyses to these more smaller scale looking very detailedly into the evolutionary history of these key regulators. And here, I'm not going to go through the trees, it's going to be very boring, just so that in the end the picture is always the same. The things that we know are specific to that we know are really critical to sporulation, not generic functions, only happen in only appear in species that have known to form endospores. So there's some phylogenetic specificity of this program.
How in this episode, see, the tree, I assume, was made using some independent data and not the presence absence data of these teams. Is that right?
No, we just collected every single. So sigma factors are part of these very large regulators. Oh no, yeah, in this specific thing, what you have here is a taxonomic tree. If you resolve the tree, and that's something I'm going to discuss in another story, so it's the same story.
Since they're all phylogenetically, they're all displayed, how do you then separate any place-specific gene from those responsible for sporulation?
Okay, what you don't see here, because this tree is very compact, is that we sample a diversity of species. So when you get here, you basically have every single bacteria that we know of. And we resolve the history. And we know that within the branch of Firmicutes, where endosporulation is going to form, we actually have branches that we now believe are secondary losses that do not form endospores. And they don't have any branch. And those serve as control for the phylogenetic signal. That's a good point. So all those genes, by the way, are here. All these genes are here, the ones that are not. So when we now look at the list of genes, when we look at their function, the spore wall is very, the formation of the spore wall is very specific. What is not specific is the generic carbohydrate metabolism that you need to generate the precursors. That's just because there are so many sigma factors that at some point we were discussing and people were coming up with this idea, which is a generic program. And even at this level where we'd expect it to be very generic, turns out to be very, very specific.
How common is functional switching of sigma factor usage? This is just a regulatory component.
It's a good point. We're going to address it in terms of testing this experimentally afterwards. But so I don't have an absolute answer to give you. The only thing I can tell you is that when we look at these groups, so these groups here represent the specific sigma factors that we're finding. And one thing that we saw was that when we look at the other groups, the other families, they seem to be very fairly consistently annotated with the same functions. But this is a circular argument because we tend to annotate by functional similarity.
I think that was Udo's point, that these aren't entirely independent. You're generating your how you distinguish phylogenetic inheritance from functional similarity.
As I told you, within the clades that form endospores, we have species that don't. And the specific sigma factors that regulate and the sporulation has been lost in those species. So while that is theoretically possible, it becomes less likely. But the one thing that I think that it's, this is a retrospective analysis of data that other people have produced. And these allow us to do one thing, which is find a series of genes that are really very specific to sporulation that we find in 100% of endosporulating genes. So at this point, we're not asking if you are involved, we're asking, I want the most specific components because I'm looking for some sort of genomic signature that allow me to go into genome and ask, do you form endospores or not? Okay. No, that's just coincidental.
Okay.
Although, you know, in prokaryotes you have these operon-or organizations, so genes in the same pathway tend to be coded in the same polycystronic RNA. So this, there is a level that there. It's not this in this particular case. I mean, you see this highly clustered block in that one. It's just, and it's probably alphabetical order that that student was organizing this. We did not try to get that genome structure here. So I told you we wanted to find a set of genes that would be somehow indicative of. Yes, before I go into the next thing. We did not do that. And I'm trying to think. So I'm now going to give you more information than you have. You have, within endospore formation, you have at least two major flavors, the ones that are done by bacilli, and ones done by Clostridiales. And so here we already have the Clostridiales and the bacillus stuff together. So it's very unlikely that we're going to get any more thing. Now, that's something that we've been now starting to look into Clostridia-specific program, because it has interesting. It's anaerobic and it's very interesting for a variety of reasons. And there, it's very, we have many more components that we are not that are not present here. So here, we're trying to look at very core machinery, the one that would map all the way back into the origin of the tree. And so the way we just came up with a simple reasoning, which is you need to be present in, find genes that are present in 90% of the sporulating species and 5% of the non-endosporulating species. This was, we have variations on this. What are we trying to capture? Something that's really very specific for endosporulation. So why aren't we going 100, 0? Because this is something we're asking the computer to blindly find this stuff. And the computer makes errors because the criteria to give them are not very good. And so you need to give some, this is, remember the word I used before, when you use heuristics like bidirectional best hits to find orthologs, even though they work really well in bacteria, this is a hack. We have no idea, we're just assuming that if you have that property, that you're going to be orthologous. Although we made a lot of variations just for information on this criteria, it doesn't really change that much. Now here you find a list of 40 genes that we believe are very specific. If you now go through all the genomes that are out there, you realize that, so notice this is done in a relatively small number of species, a few tens of species, for which we have evidence for endosporulation, and species for which we have evidence for non-endosporulation. And then now what we're going to do is say all the species within a certain group, and we're going to realize that species that we believe are endosporulators tend to have more than close to 90% of the signature. Species that we believe are not endosporulators tend to have less than 10% of these genes, if present at all. Species for which we couldn't feel comfortable about making any statements, most of them will cluster here. So by the way, the non-endosporulators are here. You can really see them. They are almost overlapping distributions. And so most of them would be non-endosporulators. And then you have a few ones here, new ones that are predicted to be endosporulators. I'm going to come back to these ones. But at this point, and this is a problem of computational analysis, is that you make a lot. In the end, we're dealing with predictions. So I'm telling you, I predict that those things will sporulate. So before I go there, I'd like to tell you that this makes some sense. Cassandra? Yes.
Okay.
Sorry. So, before I tell you what these pieces mean, I want to tell you that here, yes.
Are there any which form exospores as well?
In this group, the ones that form exospores are here. We have two different clades forming exospores.
So, when you look for the genes which are present in the sporulating solution of traits, do you see any difference in which genes are common in these groups?
So, hold that thought one, two slides, because I'm actually going to tell you the answer to that question. I hope that the answer is no, but I hope the result will be more evident there.
Can you talk about endosporulation and exosporulation?
Well, the name is self-evident. In the sense, you form the spore is formed, so you have an asymmetric cell division that forms a different cell type. In endosporulation, what happens is that it's engulfed and goes into the mother cell and stays there until lysis. It just so happens that these really are different programs.
The spore-making machinery is similar?
No. No. So this is something, you know, I've just on a side note, I've been starting to think more about this. I don't have anything vaguely intelligent to say yet, but this issue of latency, of making up latent cell types, is something that I find fascinating. This seems to have been rediscovered multiple times in evolution. In bacteria, I'm now relatively confident to tell you that these are rediscoveries, so it's not the same thing. So understanding if you end up making latency the same way or not is something that I'm starting to get interested. Let me tell you that within that list, so at this point, if you ask anyone, they will tell you, we know all the endosporulation genes. We've done all the screens possible in the world. And we found genes that for which we did not know the function. We were very worried that we'd have false positives. So we actually, the lab of Adriano Henriques, our collaborator, the guy with the amber, they actually tested this all. So they did two types of tests. There's more stuff, but the generic idea is that they knock down the gene and ask if you reduce endospore formation. And then they ask if they have differential gene expression partition between mother and spore. So you have a loss of function experiment in the sort of description of gene expression partition. There's no gain of function. Actually, that's something no one has ever done. But at this point, because they, when you delete them, you reduce or abolish endosporulation, and then they partition between mother and cell, which is a very key property of endospore formation. We're convinced that we even discovered new participants in the endospore formation, which was kind of everybody was very excited at the time. Even though from a bioinformatician's perspective, phylogenetic profiling, that's the name of what we're doing, is the easiest way of predicting new genes for something, for a function. So it's really not a surprise for us. But I started with questions. And the questions were, when did endosporulation emerge in evolution? And the answer, unfortunately, is we cannot find of those genes that are specific to endosporulation, so those that only appear in the endospore-forming genes, or they appear mostly in endospore-forming genes, they are restricted to the firmicutes. And firmicutes is not a basal group of bacteria. It's actually, it does not map to the origin of life, suggesting that this was something that was invented after bacterial life existed on Earth. So, no luck there. So we estimated probably between 2.5 to 3 billion years ago, that's the estimated age for the origin of firmicutes. There is a coincidence that got some people excited. You know, that at some point, there's a new cell type that comes on Earth called cyanobacteria. They start polluting the planet with this nasty, toxic gas called oxygen. We call this the great oxidation event because the composition of atmosphere completely changed. And some people have been very excited that between 2.3 billion and 2.53, there is a big coincidence. I'm just sharing this, and that this may be the origin for the need of having such a resistant cell type. I personally don't buy it, but since people more intelligent than me find it very exciting, I decided to share it. The second question that we ask is, what is the relationship with exosporulation? So, it's actually, there's a lot known about endospore formation. There's, particularly at the time, there's far less known about exospore formation in bacteria. So we have representatives of two groups. That's what these pinky things here represent. And if you look at the gene patterns of conservation, they're not distinct from the non-sporulating genes, or if you want, this is mycobacteria, tuberculosis, and close friends, which was an hypothesis we're specifically testing at the time. There's really not a major difference between the the genes that are specific to endospore formation don't really appear in the exospore formation. So this suggests that the programs, they are probably going to be very different. When we know, go and read the literature about these, you realize that the components are different, so there's no reason to believe they might be the same. So this is a demonstration of something people sort of knew. And now, the one thing that came out of here.
Put that back up, and what may be more striking than that is, at least at this level of resolution, it is in theory that there are differences between those exosporulating planes and the non-sporulating.
Yeah.
On
the genes that we know really control endosporulation and are relatively specific. Yeah, but you're right. Yeah.
And you're confident that that's not an artifact of your annotation process, right? That you started this curation focused on endosporulation.
We started this curation looking for genes that are important on endospore formation. We tried to get a comprehensive list of all the genes that are needed to make an endospore. Of those, we had components that are present in every single bacteria, and genes that are only existing in species that are known to form endospores. So there, I don't think that we are introducing any biases.
So if you had started with an eye towards looking at exosporulation?
We have not done that. At the time, there's really not that much data available. This is something that we are, because of this question here, how do you actually make a spore? The moment I make a claim, I've invented a whole new cell type. I'm inventing a new differentiation program. How do I do this? It's a question that we've started addressing. Very descriptive, trying to understand what genes do you need, where do they come from, do you need to invent new domains, we just do recombinations. And there, at that level, and I think now it's possible that we know more about exosporulation, understanding if in the end you're going to use the same generic building blocks. But at this time, we had no idea. And so I don't know how to answer your question. The one thing that at this point was, I guess all bioinformaticians have this idea of giving something back to other people to use. And I was very excited, this diagnostic predictive genomic signature, it's a very long name. And it turned out to be much to give rise to the most interesting part of the paper for me, which was the discussion. Because what we did was, it made me wonder if endosporulation is, like you read in every textbook, a stress response. So let me just tell you first the story about Bacillus subtilis. For those of you that are not in the area, Bacillus subtilis was isolated a few decades ago from the soil, so it's considered a soil bacterium. And then was taken to the lab, plated, irradiated, and then a single colony gave rise to most of the lab strains that you use. We actually have an historical record of who got the isolates from whom. I'll show you later that we've managed to reconstruct that history. It's quite interesting. But the point is that this is a wild isolate that was plated, irradiated, and has been plated for generations, adapting to the petri dish. Bacillus subtilis is a bacteria highly adapted to live in a petri dish at this point. We are now dealing with, as you will see, a lot of wild isolates of Bacillus subtilis. There's data, which I'll just pass on, they actually, endospore formation dynamics completely different. They form endospores by default. Actually, they're always forming endospores. Whereas a Bacillus subtilis in the petri dish, you really need to work really hard to make it, you need to starve it, give it really nasty conditions, and then it forms an endospore. Take a wild isolate and it forms endospores like that. That seems to be what it does every other division or something. Now, when we took this genomic signature and look at the little thicker line there, so those species that we now predict form endospores that were not just yet another type of Bacillus or yet another type of Clostridium. We got a list of species. We got a list of species that's really surprising. Phylogenetically, they're still within the group. They're still Firmicutes, but you got a lot of extremophiles. And a bacterium that lives at the bottom of the sea at 95 Celsius, I don't really understand why you need a stress response, because your life is stress. Either you deal with that or you don't. The idea of you occasionally make a resilient cell type doesn't really, I just don't get it. So that's the first thing. The other thing is that, as you can see here, So Eobacterium rectali, Ruminococcus albums, these are gut bacteria. And what we know is that there's many gut symbionts that exist that live in permanent associations in animal guts. One example, for example, is for this little furry animal that has these metabacterium polyspora. Notice something. This is something you're now trying to address in the lab. How do you go from one to many? This guy follows multiple spores. This is Epulopis. This is a symbiont of the sturgeon fish. This is actually the largest bacteria that we know. It has 0.7 millimeters. You actually can see it naked eye. It's a fascinating bacteria. It has about 10,000 copies of its chromosome. They all cluster around the plasma, and it forms, again, multiple spores. These guys are a dime a dozen. This is where it seems to be one of the favorite niches of endospore-forming bacteria is the gut. I'd say the gut is not the most stressful environment in the world, but what it does have is that it's a transitory environment. So you go through the gut, you're very happy, you live an exciting life, and then oxygen comes again. And this is something I really like about going into the old literature. Before people got so excited with screens, people actually went around doing characterizing individual things. And you find a lot of descriptive work on species like these, Enterobacter polyendosporus, which I'm just going to read it. So it was isolated from the soil, hence the shovel. Growth under unfavorable conditions, for example, at 40, 45 Celsius, was characterized by frequent occurrence of very long rot and rarely producing spores. So this is 45 degrees Celsius, very unpleasant for the bacteria. Under conditions favorable for growth, mass sporulation occurred on all solid media tested in batch cultures. So this idea that you make spores to resist stress, I don't think this is a generic property. Clearly something that happens in Bacillus subtilis, in the Petri dish, that's a given. Although it really begs the question, which I think is, now what's the point of endosporulation? And this is something that really is one of those things that it bugs me. I don't really have a good answer for that. And at this point, our strategy has been, so while I related screening and just going randomly finding things, we decided that the best answer to that question is going out into the world, finding endosporulating organisms in different environments, and trying to get some sort of logic out of big numbers. So there's two. So we actually joined a series of deep sea expeditions. These are 12 books of our scientific nave in Portugal, and all of this is coordinated by Ricardo and is in our lab and with Jack. And in collaboration with other authorities, so Portugal is an interesting country, so different parts of water have different authorities. They don't talk to each other. They're usually very hostile to each other. So we go from walk a few meters and you're no longer talking to these guys, and you start talking to these guys, and then you start talking to the Navy, which is a problem. They're very formal. But anyway, so we're dealing with all of them, mostly looking at different seawater sources. And this is Paula, as a postdoc in the lab. She's looking at brackish water and different sources. And she is isolating stuff. We're finding a lot of surprises about so far no major insight on this particular exposition or in sporulation. Yes. Any stress will make high temperature, no nutrient, chemicals, everything makes them sporulate. It's not specific to one type of stress. I don't know. Although I can tell you that they're highly resistant. Once you make a spore is highly resistant to radiation. Now, the one environment that we decided to focus was in the gut of mammals. So you have fine specimens, guts of animals, we have fine specimens here. And we are collaborating with a company very interested in probiotics to make all these fine specimens feel better. Believe it or not, there's a huge probiotic industry into shrimp farming. The one piece of information I didn't give you is that these bacillus, endospore-forming bacteria, is when you go into the shop and buy probiotics, you're probably going to find lots of them, lots of endospore-forming bacteria. And even Bacillus subtilis, you can go, I'm sure you can go to a health shop now and buy something with a fancy name, and that's just spores of Bacillus subtilis. So we are collaborating with ESM to trying to understand the adaptation to the gut. And this is the work of a postdoc in lab called Patricia Brito. This is very long, very long. I'm just going to give you a small vignette. So this is on Bacillus subtilis. We've basically collected data on genomes from multiple environments. Some of them we had to generate from scratch, so we had no available data for gut bacteria, because people just don't make it available in general. So DSM gave us loads of genomes of the strains that they have in-house. In this particular analysis, at this time, we only have three different strains, one from chicken gut, and one from sheep's gut, and the other one, I don't remember, some of them livestock gut, don't remember, it's not human. And then, and coming back to a question that was asked earlier on, Patricia spent months trying to understand what is a Bacillus subtilis. And from a phylogenetic perspective, you have a series of highly similar. So first of all, if you go into the database and download every single genome from some that is labeled Bacillus subtilis, you're going to have a list of species that are not monophyletic. Some of them are in the completely different branches of the tree of life, so there's a lot of misannotation and misclassification of these species. And then when do you stop being a Bacillus subtilis and become a Bacillus, whatever, something else? We have weird names here. This was something that Patricia spent a lot of time dealing with. In the end, we got concatenated gene phylogeny, so we calculate what's called core genome, those genes that are present in every single species that we wanted to analyze. So this little tree here involves 685 genes, so it's a concatenated data set of 520,000 nucleotides. And then we can resolve the tree. There's something that is paradise for people in molecular evolution, that is glory, but it's not that interesting. But the fact that we can resolve this phylogenetic history within the group with confidence allow us to now say these things, make the states I'm going to make. Adaptation to the lab happened twice. So this is what is the color code. This blue here and this blue here are independent adaptations to the lab. This is something, by the way, I'm starting with this because this we knew. I told you this is the one that was irradiated. This is one where we actually have an historical record of people giving clone isolates to other labs and doing stuff. This we all know it's very different, so it's just phylogenetic demonstration that's a different isolation. So this is weird. And then we can find that. So here in the plant-associated niches, you realize that some bacillus actually live within plants. Within the roots of plants in the soil. Actually, they are probiotics for plants, believe it or not. You can buy them and throw them on the roots of your cultures. Supposedly, they are better for them. And we can find is that you have multiple independent adaptations to living in what's called the rhizosphere. And the same thing goes for the gut, which is, this one we've already published, that's why it has a code, BSP1, 2, and 4, these are guts. So they seem to have, at this level of resolution, different independent adaptations. So, yeah?
I mean, does that actually mean that they adapted to the gut multiple times, or just that they were found that isolates from various different parts of this tree were found in the gut? You haven't really told us anything about adaptation here.
I'm going to hand wave, and then I'm going to answer your question with a negative. Is that okay? So to make a long story short, we assumed that if they live in this environment, that they are adapted to it. This is an assumption we made. And under this assumption, and what Patricia has been doing, trying to understand the genome dynamics of these bacteria, she found that they have an open pan genome, meaning that even though we sequence on higher tens of genomes of Bacillus subtilis, this is the same species, that we are nowhere close to covering the gene space. Every time we sequence a new species, find new genes. We have frequent horizontal gene transfers, and this is something to make this statement. There's a lot of work involved here, so this is not just hand-waving. This is actually just formal methods to do this. And what we find is that the bacteria that live in the gut, when we find where do the genes that we believe are coming from horizontal gene transfer come from, they tend to come from taxa that we know are associated with the gut. I don't know if they're in the same gut or not. We're just talking about genomes in databases. Yeah? And now this is the last the icing on the cake is we believe that some genes may segregate with gut strains. And this would be really exciting because the question is there adaptation or not? Let's see. I'm going to tell you one example, again, more on the vignette level, what does it mean to get a new gene? So this is experiments done in this thing called BSP1. It's one of the gut strains. This comes from sheep's gut. What we found is that, so this is actually an outdated tree, but this is what you find in most genes that are highly conserved everywhere. And then you have genes that occasionally have these very weird profiles, so in which they appear in some species, in isolated species, but they're not widely distributed. So this is part of what's called pangenome. And we found is that this pair of genes, which have a number, which tended to appear always together. It's very rare that you see them independently. And we found them in the three gut-associated species, and then in very few other niches. And we thought maybe this is one of the cute examples to look into. So what they have done, they went into this bacteria, the same bacteria that we found to have the gene. So this is what wild type looks. So this is a biofilm, and they happen to form this pigment. Now they deleted it, and you can find that biofilm formation from at a visual perspective seems to be affected. They form less wrinkles than normally form here. When you double the quantity of this gene by the so-called BSMA, it's an amylase, for those that are interested, you actually again make this phenotypic, this wrinkle formation biofilm much more intense. So, and the reason why I gave you these examples is to show you that adding this gene, pair of genes, actually has phenotypic consequences. So, because one of the things we're very worried is like, what is a gene going to do to a bacteria that has 4,000 genes? What's the big deal? So it seems that some of the things that we're finding in these studies have phenotypic consequences. Now to answer David's question. So our whole assumption from day one is that if you live in a given environment, you should be adapted to it. Until someone asks exactly the question that you ask, but what makes you think they are adapted? And it was like someone poured a bucket of ice water on us. Like, what? And the answer is, I actually don't really have any good answer to give you. Because we don't know at this stage if for each one's... Because the problem we're facing is that we collected, or people have collected, Bacillus subtilis from different niches, and then we have an annotation. This one exists in the soil. But I don't know if this is a soil-dwelling bacteria or it's a poo-dwelling bacteria that was left there, and I don't, because the poo was some time ago, I don't see the poo anymore, the spore is still there. So what we're trying to do now is to, and this is something we're doing in this company, trying to sample multiple poos, I guess, from the farm, trying to understand the dynamics of these species within the different, of these bacilli within the different species, in the hope of finding something, some indication for hysteria specificity to host, at least. But I don't have a good answer about the soil now. But regarding the plants, we know they're not just soil; they're inside a plant, so it's not just a little bit of soil. So I hand waved a bit, but the answer is I don't know if there is adaptation or not. I have no answer to the question. Some time ago, I was really looking for a formal definition of adaptation. I found something by, what's the guy that said nothing in biology makes sense except life evolution, Dobzhansky, and says it's the ability of an organism to live in its environment, something that's very generic. So here, what we'd expect is something that allows you to live specifically in that environment, not others. That's, I guess, would be the finding genes that are specific to niches would start giving us some confidence that might be adaptation if the moment you remove them, you're no longer able to live or compete as well in that environment. We've been talking about that. In the sense that, yes, and that's where we would like to go. The experimental design is not very clear. That's what like that. We're not really in the plans. We've been discussing with the company. Let's put that, we can discuss this later, but we are having problems with experimental design. We need to have some sort of hypothesis to test about what specific genes you need to take or out what's going to be your measure of fitness. But Cassandra. It is. It's, yeah. I mean, this branch here, we know, I think it's about 50 years old. And remember that this is a tree built on the things that exist everywhere. So resolving this was complex. So I'm not going to dwell too much on this because I just wanted this as a vignette. So I just gave the first quarter of my talk. And now I need to make decisions. So, yes. Yeah.
If you knock them out, you see that they form less spores, or forming less spores itself would be a measure of fitness if you want to look at how they do without spore forming ability less or more that way. For survival, if you knock some of those genes, they might live shorter lives.
In the petri dish, I actually don't know what this means into the wild. I don't know enough about the biology of these organisms. This is personal ignorance, it's not community ignorance. But that these bacteria are cannibals. Occasionally they just go, they have this random suicide switch, and they have this ability to go on others, to induce in others this random suicide switch, and then try to eat the remains of what's out there. Which means that the picture becomes a little bit more complicated because sporulation is associated in terms of genetic circuits to this random suicide switch. I'm very happy to go over that with you afterwards. Although, to be honest, I doubt that I can give you much more than what I gave you because I don't know enough about it. Okay, so in the interest of time, and I think because of I'm not going to tell you about that part, because everything I was going to tell you, or most of what I was going to tell you, was published. I'm going to tell you a little bit about how eukaryotes get to live in eukaryotes, because this is the unpublished data, and I think it might be more interesting. This is Listeria living inside an animal cell, playing with the actin cytoskeleton to its own purposes. So when people talk about adaptation, this would be one of the slides I would immediately show you, because it's not you do something you do randomly. You know, you have to evolve specific mechanisms for this. I just want to give you one key idea here, because I told you I like students to see that we study these things at different levels. And there's one level which is a more of an abstract property of the genome as a whole rather than the presence of gene A or B. And in that, what we, this guy is a physicist that came to the lab wanting to do a master thesis, and it was the only student I could convince to do this study because everybody else thought it wasn't going to work out. But I was very interested about environmental predictability. Because if you read the literature, everybody, it says that you need to have environmental unpredictability to evolve and stably maintain a lot of what's called redundancy, to have multiple ways of doing the same function. And what happens when you become an intracellular parasite is that we know, and this is something that's well known, you're going to lose genes. And so if you want, it's a very simple way of putting this is that life is like this pile of screws. You don't really know what screw cap you have to deal with, and you know that while you need generic screwdrivers, that you need them slightly different from each other. So this is a metaphor, for example, for all the enzymes of the same family that you need. You may have enzymes that generically cut carbohydrates, but then you need them to specific for each carbohydrate. And so because of that, you need many screwdrivers. Now, if life is predictable, meaning if you know that tomorrow is going to give you exactly the same challenges as today, and this is what happens if you live in a invariant environment, which happens to be the inside of the cell, which seems to be very, very stable, then you don't really need all those screwdrivers. Just choose the one or two that you need, and that's it. And that's the hypothesis that we're testing here. And the reason I want to discuss with the students, and maybe we can discuss afterwards, is that for us to test this hypothesis, whereas so far I've been telling you, we can just analyze patterns of genes, presence, absence here, it's more an abstract level. For us to deal with this, we had to simulate genome evolution to start contrasting these with all the empirical data. So we do more than just counting stuff. Sometimes we ask the computer to count for us. Now, I want to do something different, which is this idea, how does an eukaryote get to live inside eukaryotes? And this is something, well, I don't know if you've got the picture, but I really get this idea of cells living inside cells. I find it absolutely fascinating. And what I'm going to tell you is a three-way nested relationship. And this happened in my life, so I'm going to tell you about Perkinsus. Perkinsus came into my life when Ricardo showed up in the lab saying, I want to do a postdoc with you. And by the way, I bring goodies. I bring flasks with stuff growing there. And they, interesting, so this is part of a continuation of the work that he did at SMR and his PhD at the Algarve with Leonard Cancela. Perkinsus for the Portuguese is a catastrophic parasitic species because it kills clams, and clams is something that it's very dear to us. If you ever go to Portugal, you need to eat that. Popularized, not many writers get a recipe with their names. This is bouillon pato, journalists and writers, and this is called clams cooked bouillon pato way. So it's detailed, but it's, again, for Portuguese, this is, clams are very important. Now, Perkinsus is an alveolate, a superphylum that contains lots of interesting things. So you guys would know about Plasmodium, their intracellular parasites. You guys know about Toxoplasma, so these are the apicomplexa. But it also includes weird organisms like dinoflagellates. Dinoflagellates, which have these weird cellulosic plates on the outside that have a lot of endosymbiotic relationships with each other, to the point where you can have a dinoflagellate living parasitically inside another dinoflagellate, which in itself, this one in particular is a photosynthetic one, you can see by the red pigment. This happens everywhere. This Zooclorella is actually a huge permissium-like organism filled with eukaryotic alga. And this is something that happens in this particular clade, which is a joy for people who like cells within cells, is that you have a lot of secondary and tertiary endosymbiosis. It's not going to be very relevant here. Oh, actually, I've used this. So they have these Perkinsonids have a very interesting intracellular organization. They have all sorts of weird organelles. If you're interested in the membrane system, they're very cool. The point that's relevant here is that they are, if you look at the organism, at this tree here, is that they're basal dinoflagellates. So dinoflagellates are uber weird in any way you can think of, and this is the normal closest cousin of the weirdos. So it's in that respect, it's a very interesting system to study. It was initially discovered in 1946 by a guy called Perkins. It was identified as a parasite responsible for many mortalities, and now it's now called Perkins' SP, and it's the blight of all the shellfish farming all over the world. If you like oysters, if you like clams, if you like abalones or anything, so you don't like this guy. As a system, it's very interesting because it's diverged, but it seems to have co-evolved with different hosts. So in different parts of the world, you have different Plasmodium species, and they tend to have different tropism for specific species. Some are incredibly specific. Some will infect different types of bivalves. It has the one thing that I found most interesting is that it's a facultative intracellular parasite. It means that it can replicate outside. It forms this sporangia there and these zoospores. This is not sexual division, by the way. I've been told by the people who knows. By the way, I should warn you that from now on, every time you have a question, look at Ricardo and ask him. Because he's the guy that actually is a world authority on these Plasmodium things. And it can go into the cell and replicate both extracellular and intracellularly in different cell types, giving rise to progeny. And what we thought was interesting to look into was Perkinsus. Maybe you can tell us how you can become an intracellular parasite, and above all, even start questions about how do you become an obligate intracellular parasite, because you're somewhere in sort of an intermediate stage. And eventually, we want to deal with host restrictions we haven't looked at. So in this day and age, the first thing that you do is you sequence the genome. The sequence and that hopeful clues there, that's what we've done. I just want to make a point here. I don't want to go through all these. These are other alveolate species. This is free living. These guys are not. If you look at the gene count here, about 14,000, you compare to the numbers of the intracellular parasites. They tend to be small, except for Toxoplasma. This one did not experience any major gene loss like you'd expect in intracellular parasites. It's still free living. There's a lot of curiosities on this genome that I'm just going to highlight a couple. Just, we don't really know what they mean, to be honest, at this point. There's lots of introns. So every single gene has its tiny introns. I think Wallace Marshall told you about Stentor, I believe. Did he? So, and they are very puzzled with these intron structures. So these guys have a weird intron structure too. Don't really know. Get it? It's about almost a third of the genome is organized into operons, multicistronic mRNAs, exactly like bacteria. It's not a case. We've tested some of them, and we know that, in fact, this is a polycistronic mRNA, so it's not a genome annotation issue. But this, you sequence the genome, you got files on your computer, and now it's time for you to start doing something interesting with them. And what Ricardo did is do what's called a metabolic reconstruction. There's one thing that bioinformaticians can do decently is try to predict the metabolic network of an organism. You initially do it automatically, and then you sit down and go gene by gene, trying to understand where would you fit on the system. And you end up with, you have things to do that. This is generated by something called pathway tools. You end up with these maps, which at this distance, or even at this distance, are pretty non-informative. And then you start looking what pathways are there. And one surprise that we had was that salvage pathways coexist with de novo pathways. So this is an example. You have the ability to synthesize folate, but you also have the ability to process it from the environment. And this is the generic pattern we kept seeing. Every time we have a biosynthetic pathway, you also had a salvage pathway. Now, and then Ricardo got the idea of doing an experiment, which I think that was really awesome, which is he tricked Perkinsus. So he grew Perkinsus in the presence of hemocytes from the clam, so physically separated with a filter that doesn't allow the cells to actually physically touch each other, but where chemicals may circulate. And now Perkinsus apparently believed that it was invading a clam cell because it changed its expression pattern. And what changed was that while the free-living cell would normally would have a biosynthetic pathway active, the moment it sees the Perkinsus hemocytes, it switches off that program and activates the salvage pathway, so the one that allows it to scavenge from the media. And this was a very generic phenomenon that we found over and over again, suggesting that this idea of the compartmentalization of these programs would actually make this transition between facultative, say, free-living organism into an obligate parasite very simple, because you could lose one program without affecting the ability to replicate inside. So the hypothesis is we don't really have a lot of ways to test this. We, however, have some evidence that Perkinsus might in itself be on the way to becoming an obligate intracellular parasite. There's one, by analogy to bacterial endosymbionts and intracellular parasites, we know that what you see is a lot of genome compaction, and this is something we see happening in Perkinsus. We know that Perkinsus doesn't really like to replicate outside. I mean, it does it, but it's not where it feels most happy. We have mitochondria. I'm not going to give you anything more about mitochondria. It's very interesting. It's clearly a degrading mitochondria. So at this point, we have this hypothesis that you might be actually finding a transitioning state, and I'll give you another piece of evidence there. What we want to do next with this is that I told you that Perkinsus is an interesting position on the tree of life. And there's this group called Parkinsoa in general, that includes many other species. Now, we know very little about these other species, but I can tell you that this Parvulucifera is an obligate intracellular parasite. It infects dinoflagellates. It replicates inside dinoflagellates. People have been looking at them as ways to controlling algal blooms. When you look at the morphology of infection sporangial formation, they're very, very similar to parkinsonids. So we now start discussing with people trying to get access to these isolates from these to try to compare the genomes to see what we can do with them. But this is where hopefully we'll take this idea. Next, since I'm not going to have time to discuss the final quarter of my talk, which would be about tools, tell you that that's something that we have always had this worry that every time you do some sort of analysis and you have to create code or anything, you try to you make an effort to make it available to the community. So at this point, we have we made all these available, all the metabolic reconstruction, everything that we've done on this is publicly available. Now, I want to tell you one thing. So I was trying to decide here if I'm going to give you the next part on Parkinson's. I'm still going to use 10 minutes to tell you about protein repertoires. Okay, what makes it so interesting is this whole group here is that, so this is a highly distorted eukaryotic tree. So we are here somewhere at the tip of these, then there's amoeba, which are closest cousins, and then everybody else. And everybody else is very diverse, but the one thing that happens is that everybody else has had plastid envy. So they look at algae, they see you have a very nice chloroplast, I'd like to have you, and they get find ways of getting chloroplasts incorporated into their own cells into what's called endosymbiosis. Typically, we call them secondary endosymbiosis because it's a symbiosis. I think it's easier. Actually, I have something helped that would work here. So this is an eukaryotic red algae, so it has its nucleus, it has a bacteria living inside, a red bacteria. This is an animal cell, it has no, it has mitochondria, but no more. This guy also has mitochondria, I was lazy. And to do is that what we know that happens in the history of Parkinson's is that Parkinson's in the past, the ancestor of Parkinson's, ate, associated something with a eukaryotic algae, and now has a eukaryote living inside. This nucleus has disappeared, but it still has the plastid. So that's this reduced chloroplast that's no longer photosynthetic as far as we know. The same way that Plasmodium has a plastid that is no longer photosynthetic. And now this animal cell is going to go infect a clam cell or an oyster cell. So you end up with these highly these nested three eukaryotic cells with a cell within a cell within a cell. There's relationships far more complex than these, actually, for secondary endosymbiosis. This is kind of lame. And the point is what happened to the plastids of Parkinson's, because it's no longer photosynthetic. It's now becoming a parasite, so it doesn't really need to, it's not using its photosynthetic machinery anymore. If you look into literature, there's a suggestion, however, that you might still have something there. So first is a phylogenetic argument that all its close relatives have it, so you should have it too. And then there's data that so far we are not able to reproduce, that there's a 3-4 membrane compartment observable by electron microscopy. 3-4 membranes is a typical diagnosis of a secondary endosymbiosis of eukaryote in situ eukaryote inside an eukaryote. Now, when we looked at this genome, we were very, very surprised because we found more than 300 genes that are predicted to target the apicoplast because they have what's a very clear bipartite signal. However, they were all nuclear, so they were adjacent to genes that we'd expect to find in every other eukaryote and that we'd expect to be part of the nuclear genome. We find the full complement of transporters that are very, again, very diagnostic of a secondary endosymbiosis because you basically need to have duplicated transporters for both pairs of membranes, and we find them there. However, no matter how much we try, we cannot find any genome, any independent genome, meaning we find the genes, they are in the nuclear genome, but we cannot find any thing that would look like a chloroplast or placidial genome. We find mitochondria very easily. We covered it 400 times. And this was done, this sequencing project involved two different technologies, sequencing preparation. So if we find mitochondria 400 times, we're very surprised not to find the plastid here. And at this point, our working hypothesis that either the plastid is not there, or it's a plastid without a genome. Whatever happens, whatever is the hypothesis, is very interesting. So this is something, this is where we are stuck in this project trying to solve this specific problem. So Ricardo found a Japanese thesis. Okay. No, they all reduce, okay. We know when in bacteria, so when you eat, when our ancestor ate a alpha proteobacteria to give rise to mitochondria, a phenomenon called endosymbiotic gene transfer happened. So most of the genes migrated from the mitochondrial genome to the nucleus. But however, in most cases mitochondria, with some exceptions that I'm going to discuss next, the mitochondria always retains a few genes. There's discussions why you do that or not in terms of control. The only cases where we don't see this is in these very reduced mitochondria called mitosomes and some cases of hydrogenosomes. So these are derived organelles that have lost genome. To the point for a long time we thought these organisms had no mitochondria. Now it's obvious that they do, highly reduced ones. In the chloroplast, the same thing happens. So in the lineage giving rise to plant, most of the genes moved into the nuclear genome. Again, you tend to retain a few genes in the chloroplast. Now, this is primary endosymbiosis. In secondary endosymbiosis, endosymbiotic gene transfer is not that well known. And what our data would suggest is that, A, it happens. It's very, very frequent because it's been all of the genes that would target there, about 300, would have moved to the nucleus. So there is endosymbiotic gene transfer in secondary endosymbiosis. And if, and I need to show you a piece of evidence next, if it is a fact that we have an organelle without a genome, an endosymbiotic organelle without a genome, it would be the first time that anything on the green lineage would have that. Because we know that's possible in mitochondria. We did not know that it was possible in chloroplast-derived organelles, and even less in secondary endosymbiosis. Okay. So the piece of data that it needs, although I need to, this is a figure in a Japanese thesis that we don't have no control of this. We're trying to reproduce this data. I should tell you, we've been collaborating with expert electron microscopists that are really useful to look at section of these things, and we cannot find these multiple membrane compartments that we'd expect. But there's a thesis out there stating that if you stain Purkinje cells with, say, anything that stains an enzyme that is typically targeted to apicoplast, say, isoprenoid metabolism, which are typical, this pathway is associated with this. And then you stain for DNA, this is what's shown in green here. And then you stain with DAPI for DNA, that they never co-occur. That the enzymes that would normally label an apicoplast do not co-occur with DAPI staining, with DNA staining. This is the extent of the evidence, these two pictures. I'm sorry I don't have the reference of the thesis here. I don't know where I put it. But this is the extent, it's the only thing we have, and there's no more. So we're trying to test this hypothesis, asking, is there any way that there might be a chloroplast-derived organelle, so a secondary endosymbiosis without a genome? So far, we have no evidence, but we still have a lot to do ahead of us. Although the other alternative, so this is the one that excites me. Ricardo seems to favor the idea that maybe they lost it in culture, that you can actually lose the whole symbiont. Since we have no data whatsoever to suggest, and he has more experience than I do, probably is right. But this is where we are at the moment, trying to understand how these two cells get together. So I had another 15 minutes to give you one proteins, which I'm not. Yeah. I knew this was going to be complex. I just want to tell you, this, since this is one slide, I think I can. So we've been doing a lot of work on coiled coils. So coiled coils are a specific protein domain that is very important in organizing the cytoplasm. They normally either protein interaction modules or involved in transient interactions, or they're physical rods. Actually, the things that keeps the Golgi organized, supposed to call Golgi, motors, the thing that separates head and the rest of the proteins are coiled coils, the thing that brings vesicles together and gives them the strength to attach our coiled coils. I mean, they're everywhere. And we've been looking at, because there's a lot of people claiming that literature says that you don't see anything out of coiled coils. There's no phylogenetic signal. We published our data, so you can read it's claiming that's wrong. Actually, there's a lot of phylogenetic signal there. We developed new tools to analyze coiled coils. But one thing I wanted to do, and this takes 2 minutes, and then I'll finish, is to tell you something we've done with students at EMBL a couple years ago, which was to test this hypothesis that if coiled coils are rods, and that the spacing, so what they do is to keep things apart, then instead of looking at sequence conservation, despite the fact that there is a lot of sequence conservation, it's just something as simple as space. And this is something that when we look into PDB, what we're putting here is the physical length of the protein measure. So a coiled coil, by the way, is with alpha helices wrapping around each other. And you can see that every time you add a new amino acid to sequence, you actually grow the length of your coiled coil, whereas if you take a global domain, I mean, this is just defining the radius of gyration, it's not even that exciting, but you don't have this type of relationship. And notice how the correlation, this is real data, this is not a modeling or anything, it's actually just really physically measuring the rods, and the correlation of these is 0.999 something. It's really, one amino acid means you grow by a certain length, it's a ruler. And we just wanted to test this hypothesis when I went to teach this course at Woods Hole. I took a TA there with me, it was Johan, which meantime has finished his PhD. And this girl, who is now a medical student, decided, oh, I think it's a good idea, let me test this. And what she has done was basically do all the case studies that formed this study, which is, and I just want to give you these case studies, because this is about looking at proteins at a different level. We're not looking at sequence motifs or if the genes are there or not, but asking, what is your size? And this is just an example. So, for example, this is a transcription factor. These are orthologs mapped on the tree phylogenetically. And this is the domain architecture. And you can find that while the size of the protein can vary a lot, the domain organization, so each of these boxes is an independent domain, the size of the coiled coil, this is a predicted coiled coil. We're actually very good at predicting coiled coils, so these predictions are okay. That the size is invariant. And then, I forgot to remove that, sorry. And this is a case study. We've done this over multiple branches of the tree of life. Any protein that you look at into coiled coils, they always have the same property. And the other thing that we notice is that if you now take any one protein and take it over the tree of life and start plotting sequence conservation versus size conservation, is that in green you can see sequence divergence increasing. It's what happens as in evolution when you compare proteins, the more distant orthologs tend to be less similar. If you look at the variance of size, actually, even though there's fluctuations, it's completely independent and it tends to be more constant. Again, we compared throughout the tree of life, and that's always something that happens. So first of all, I wanted to illustrate a different level of analysis, not asking, is my gene there? What does this gene do? We're asking about generic physical properties of proteins, and something as simple as size can be actually what drives what is the dominant signal when you compare these groups of orthologs. Here?
No, on the right. I mean, the graph on the right.
I don't remember. I need to look into the manuscript. I'm sorry. I have the information there, but I don't remember by heart. But it doesn't really matter because they are linearly correlated. So this, while the scale is relevant, it doesn't change if you put number of amino acids or if you put physical length.
Well, then, I mean, if you have both domain and a globular domain, right, you expect that you can improve.
No, this is only the length conservation. I'm sorry, I didn't say it's just for the coil-coil. We're just measuring the coil-coil. So I just wanted to, very emphasize, so I know this was very superficial. I just wanted this mostly for the student to give you a different level of analysis. We're looking at conservation of physical properties rather than is my gene there, does it do anything? So, anyway, let's finish. I just need to thank, so these are the people who actually do all the work. I just faff around and then try to look good talking about it. There's a lot of people who give us money. Thank you very much. There's a hypothesis about the process. I need to squeeze my brain to get it because people have discussed them. So the process exists that allows you to move the DNA into if there is any adaptive value to that or not. Is this under selection or not? I don't know of anyone who has addressed that question. I only have empirical data that it happens. So I don't have an answer to your question. I'm sorry. But it seems to be something that happens on a very regular basis. I mean, just to give you an extreme example, you have this endosymbiote called Drosophila ananas, which is a Drosophila that lives in rotten pineapples. Many Drosophila have this endosymbiont called Wolbachia. In Drosophila ananas, there's a full genome integrated into its chromosome, the full bacterial genome. This is an extreme example. But in almost every case of permanent associations, you have transfer of genes from the symbiont to the nucleus. Now, this has been very well studied in terms of bacterial symbionts. In eukaryotic symbionts, it's pretty open terrain. But selection, no idea. So there is this big discussion about what makes a symbiont versus what makes an organelle. So you have, say, Buchnera, which is I'm giving you examples of bacteria living inside eukaryotes because the idea of eukaryotes living inside eukaryotes is really poorly explored. So it's really not a lot. But on bacteria, so you have examples where you have extreme examples of mitochondria and chloroplast with this extensive transfer, and then you have stable associations with millions of years old, like Buchneras, that live inside insects, of which you have no endosymbiotic genes transfer that I know of. Some people got very excited some time ago because a new association between a cyanobacteria and a eukaryote, which is an amoeboid type thing, was discovered. It's Paulinella something, I think the system. And there was a claim, this was the second time we see a primary endosymbiosis with the cyanobacteria, and then there was a discussion, oh, but it's not really an organelle because there's no transfer to the nucleus. It turns out that even though this is a recent association, there's already at least one or two genes that are encoded in the nuclear genome. There's evidence that there is a targeting mechanism for them. So I think both cases exist. For the gene products, of the gene, of the bacterial genes that have been moved to the nucleus, that they are now targeted to the Paulinella something in the symbiont. But I think both cases exist, where we should have no transfer and you have extensive transfer. Outer space. No, I did answer to that. If it did, it was not a spore formed by a firmicute. That's my answer. I cannot go further than that. So life, as we know it, is supposed to have originated 3.8 billion years ago. So By the way, I think that all of these are plausible questions as long as we treat them in a scientific way. And I personally think that the idea of putting life on another planet buys us time, which is something that our current scenario don't really explain. How did we achieve so much in so little time? But it doesn't solve the problem. Now, for Bacillus subtili to have come from outer space, it would need to have lost all the signal that it has a different life form, and then have acquired all the basal machinery that characterizes all the life as we know it. So I find that very, very non-likely. I wish I could publish that paper, though. Thank you.